This Tome Show production is brought to you by Noble Knight Games, where Out of Print is available again, and listeners like you. Thanks for using the Tome's Amazon store.
Hi, I'm James Wyatt, one of the lead designers for 4th edition and author of Eberron Trilogy, The Draconic Prophecies, and you're listening to The Tome Show.
Welcome to the Tome Book Club, Episode 1. Each month we read a D&D novel, discuss it, and have fun. And in this episode, our discussion is between me, Jeff Greiner,
and me, Tracy Hurley. And in this first episode, we're going to read Twilight Falling by Paul S. Kemp, the first book in the Erebus Kale trilogy. And we also got a chance to call up the author and talk to him about the book as well.
And it's appropriate for us to be starting things off with the book club because the two of us are also the Tome Show's regular hosts. But in the future, we would like to get more of you on as well. So if you're reading along with us and you want to join in these discussions, email us at thetomeshow@gmail.com.
Now, one thing we're doing with the book club is that it's a Tome Show production. It's not quite the same as a regular Tome Show episode. It is, in some ways, a show within a show. So don't expect all the normal segments with news and whatnot each episode. This episode is just going to be about the book that we're discussing, and that's about all. So with that said, let's mention our sponsor and get along to it.
We continue to be supported by Noble Knight Games, a fantastic game store both in person and online, since we're looking at this novel and we're looking to go into the rest of the trilogy in the next few months. It's pretty easy to go ahead and make this our pick of the episode. The Erebus Kale Trilogy Omnibus Edition, available at Noble Knight for about $13. Check out the link in the show notes at thetomeshow.com and be sure to tell them that the Vorpal Network sent you so they'll continue supporting us.
Sweet.
Noble Knight Games has been serving the needs of thousands of gamers worldwide since 1997. Huge selection of over 30,000 unique products, including discounts on most in-print games of up to 50% off or more. Noble Knight Games is the place for out-of-print RPGs, board games, war games, collectible card games, miniatures, and all things game-related. They ship worldwide and will purchase or trade your titles you no longer need, new, or used. Your satisfaction is guaranteed. Just visit www.noblenight.com. Or visit our website for direct access to thousands of new, out-of-print, and in some cases, one-of-a-kind items.
All right, it is now time for us to talk about Twilight Falling, book one of the Erebus Kale trilogy by Paul S. Kemp. I've got, as usual, Tracy Hurley here with me. And woo-hoo! We are going to talk up this book in the future, where you will also be doing these conversations live with chat rooms going on, or possibly bringing people in on Skype that have read the book along with us and want to participate. So if that's something you're interested in, let us know, and we will definitely have people on so we can have more than just the two of us. This one sort of ended up coming together a little bit last minute. We didn't have a ton of time to promote when we were recording and all that kind of stuff, because that baby was born. So I got preoccupied with other things, I guess. But let's talk about Twilight Falling. We should probably make note that this is not a review, although there might be some elements of that. It is a book club chat sort of conversation, so there will be spoilers. If you plan on reading this book and don't want to be spoiled on some things, I guess listen to this later after you finish the book. And I think that would be the best advice there, because we're not going to hold anything back. We're going to talk about everything, because that's kind of the point. But let's start off a little bit easy. What do we think of the book?
Oh, that's easy. Why don't you go first?
Okay. I liked it. It's probably, I think, one of the better written D&D novels I've read in a long time. Now, not speaking about the story specifically, but in terms of the way it's written, I like the word choices and the language and that kind of stuff more than I have a lot of novels I've read. I thought the the foreshadowing that led up to the end, I thought was really nice. I kind of had my suspicions about what was going to happen at the end, and it played out the way I expected. But we'll get into that as we go along. But there were also some things that caught me by surprise. What did you think, Trace?
I liked it. I definitely think it was better in... I think maybe some of the problems I had with it were just that I still don't necessarily know a ton about the realms.
Uh-huh.
And there's a lot in here. Like, so a lot of the other Forgotten Realms books I've read have been about a very particular city or something. Yeah. And haven't had a storyline that spans across. Some of them have been a little like, this could change the world. Mm-hmm. But it's still been very centralized, like, in a very particular location, and you didn't really need to know a lot about the rest of the realms in order to understand it.
Mm-hmm.
I kept getting caught up on things, like, people from this particular area are very coin-conscious sort of stuff, and I'm just like, where is that area again? I don't understand.
Well, I was going to say, because the book happens in... basically two locations, right? It happens
right.
It happens in primarily in Symbia. I can't remember the name of the town right now. Which is the very mercantile, coin conscious sort of society I think you're referring to.
Yeah.
And then it ends up going over to Westgate and then to the wilds nearby.
Right.
So I mean, there were basically two locations. That was too much for you to...
Well, I don't think it was just that. I think it had, I felt like it had a diversity still within that location that was sometimes hard for me to keep track of.
Oh, sure.
Because, I mean, not only am I learning the words and the place names, but I'm trying to keep track of the story. And, you know, I'm trying to try to figure out what these creatures might be.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because we don't learn what the creatures are until the end. And I'm sure people who are much better versed in the realms and maybe in like D&D monsters and stuff would have guessed earlier, narrowed it down earlier.
They're more general D&D monsters than they are realm specific monsters, but it took me, I got through a good half the book before I figured out what they were.
Right. But it just felt like, as someone who's not very comfortable reading, confident yet reading realm stuff, I was slightly overwhelmed, I'll admit it.
Here's my suspicion about what happened, because I noticed some of this too. I assume you read the short story that went before it as well.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. This was despite this being book one, and a prequel short story to the Erebus Kale trilogy. After doing a little bit more digging, this is not actually the first book featuring Erebus Kale.
Okay, that might have helped.
Yeah, I think there was a previous book that was part of another series where they had, you know, three or four writers doing little one-shot stories in the realms. And so I think that's where Erebus Kale was originally introduced. And I haven't read it either because I noticed a lot of that too. They kept talking about this shadow demon story and there was a lot of, I think, assumptions about the mercantile house that Erebus Kale was working for. At the beginning of the book, that we were just supposed to kind of know,
right?
That they never really explained, because I think that happened in the previous book.
Right, and you can see how, since I haven't read a lot of Realms books, like, I have no idea why I'm feeling this way. I just know that I'm feeling a little lost. And there were times, like, when they're talking about, I don't know how to pronounce that woman's name, the kind of his love interest.
Yeah.
And I was just like... Okay, so great, this is gonna be a flashback, and I'm gonna see this part, and it's gonna, you know, humanize him and give me a new angle to the character, and then it just stopped, and like, it's understandable, but when it kept doing that, I kept getting a little annoyed.
Yeah.
I feel bad saying that.
No, I felt the same way. Now I don't know that it took me out of the story. I just sort of said, okay, well, this is stuff obviously that if I wanted to find out about, I need to go back to this other book. And read that stuff, but it didn't hurt my enjoyment of the book as it was. I suspect it maybe impacted your enjoyment of the book just because you didn't know whether you were missing something because you didn't understand the setting or because you just hadn't read part of the story.
Right.
I think it was just that uncertainty. that kept you confused. And you know, I was able to just sort of shrug it off and say, well, I haven't read that part, so I'll just move on. Whereas you kept thinking, do I just not get it?
Right.
Okay. I think that's fair. So it opens up with all of this discussion about this merchant house that he worked for, and then his master dies, and this is all the stuff that I think we're supposed to care about and know about, and it's a big sort of transition for him that we, I don't know, I didn't feel really connected to just because I hadn't read that previous story, right? But right. I sort of understood the importance that they were trying to put on it. I found it interesting that what we have is a character transitioning away from his old status quo of working for this merchant house off to these sort of individual adventures, but he keeps being pulled into the affairs of this merchant house. Like, he leaves, he retires or he quits or whatever in order to protect them from whatever's going on.
Right.
But in doing so, or after he does so, he keeps going back to that merchant house like two or three more times. It's like, dude, you quit. You're trying to protect him. Get away.
Right. Yeah. He starts putting together that there's something that it's not just him that's causing them to be in danger. The guy had bought the globe, and that's why he ends up going back. He finally puts the clues together that they're not just after him for whatever reason. They're after something that the guy he served and had bought.
Yeah, and that's
and that guy's dead now.
Right, and that's a fine line that I think the book walks, because sometimes I've seen stories do that kind of thing and it turns me off because it feels like the events of the story are happening around the characters rather than because of the characters. You know, like this guy got embroiled in this thing and there was nothing he could do about it. It was happening to him, to Erebus Kale.
Right.
It was just circumstance. But at the same time, I guess that's also sort of a classic theme in literature, you know. Things are just, you know, fated or destined to happen. And that also seems to be a theme, at least having only read the one book, this seems to be a theme that's building with Erebus Kale, because there's a lot of things that keep happening to him that are largely out of his control. And that seems to be a major theme of what's going on, is he's not sure he likes the fact that there's this sort of destiny or fate that's happening to him.
Right.
Whether it's him being chosen by, or whatever he is, of Mask, the god of thieves, or whether it be, you know, this globe falling into his hands and other people thinking that that means he knows what's going on and that he needs to be killed, or what happens to him at the end. There's just a lot of things that sort of, you know, are happening to him that are completely out of his control, but he keeps trying to say, or maintain some control over it. You know, Mask has control of me, or Mask is trying to get me to do things or manipulate me and do this, that, and whatever. But at the same time, he keeps justifying to himself, well, I'm doing these things on my own terms. Well, that may be, but you're still doing what Mask wanted you to do, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, he's... At the beginning, he's both trying to turn away from his destiny and say, I'm not going to do this, and almost passively just let it happen at the same time. You know, he doesn't take control of it either. He still prays and hopes that Mask will give him whatever he needs for the next day and stuff like that. But he's working, in my mind, he's working most of the book actively against becoming what is his destiny, which is, you know, to become a shade, right?
Yeah, well, that's what he eventually ends up happening. Although I don't know that he necessarily is acting actively against it. I feel like he's running towards it, but only in his mind is he actively against it. You know, his actions keep moving him towards his destiny.
Well, he won't kill the guy that they interrogate, for one. Even though, I mean, he probably should have.
I think what he's actively fighting against is this possible turn towards evil.
Right.
You know, he has a dark history where he's done evil things or whatever, and he's trying to be a better person now. And so I feel like that's what he's fighting against, is not necessarily this fate of working for Mask or doing things for Mask or being a shade or whatever, but it's more of he's fighting against this urge to go back to being who he was, of being an assassin and a killer and all these things.
Yeah, because it's very important to him at the beginning of the book that Ren, is that the guy's name?
Who?
Is an innocent. The guard from the house.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
From the house. and he must be saved, even if it means giving up his half of the globe in the end, because it's an innocent life at stake.
Right. And I find it interesting that they largely, I mean, he largely sort of says to himself that he went through this change because of this love interest that he knows isn't going anywhere. And he's right. He's given up on the love interest, and he's leaving that house, and he's not going to see her ever again, but he still wants to move towards being a good person. You know?
Mm.
Even though he knows that there's no chance of this love interest ever happening, and he says that she's the reason he wants to be a better person, he still seems to want to be a better person, even though she's not in the picture.
Yeah, I don't know. I wasn't a big fan of the love interest storyline.
Well, it didn't seem to... I mean, it obviously doesn't go anywhere, right? And that's sort of the whole point.
Yeah, it gets cut off really easy early, but then it almost keeps hinting as if it could happen.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't suspect it'll happen, but there's a lot of novels, so who knows? I think there's been two, maybe three trilogies now following, or this one, and then two or three, one or two more after it.
Yeah.
So there's a lot going on.
Now, yeah, I don't know.
Now let's convert this in our heads to D&D for a little bit. Because I had some interesting thoughts as I was reading this. One being, there is very seldom ever interesting stories told about what that include clerics.
Right.
And I thought it was interesting that Erebus Kael is a cleric.
Well, it's like everybody except for maybe the assassin is multiclassing.
Yes. Everybody's a rogue. Every single character is a rogue.
Yeah.
And something else.
Right. And that was the interesting part, because the other rogue, the halfling, is also has prayers too, right?
Yeah, he's well, and I don't know.
He's a harper originally. I don't know what that means, but
oh, you don't know the harpers?
No,
I will inform you. The harpers are sort of an organization of do-gooders,
okay,
that run around the realms. They're sort of like an anti-terrorist organization. Not in that they're anti-terrorists, but they're like a terrorist organization that does good instead of evil. If that makes sense. They're largely unorganized, but they have a few leaders here and there that everybody recognizes, and they all run off. If you go back to the old alignment system, the grid of nine,
right?
They were very, very chaotic good.
Okay. You
know? Loose organization. But there's harpers just sort of everywhere, and they always help each other out, and they're always doing, you know, they're always the kind of people that, hey, somebody tried to kill the king and ran off. It's almost certain that it's the harper that's, you know, jumping off the rooftops, putting their own life at risk to catch the guy.
Right.
You know, and so they're sort of the secret organization, and nobody knows who they are, but they're always out there sort of meddling and trying to do good things. They're actually originally formed in the Dale Lands in Shatterdale, if that means anything to you, by Elminster and some of his crew.
Okay.
So there's a sort of the upper level. And Elminster, at this point, doesn't really have much of anything to do with them anymore, but he was sort of instrumental in originally creating them.
Okay.
Does that help understand the Harpers?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I could get a little bit of that, like, the intense goody-two-shoes part from the way Jack, right? And
yeah.
The assassin interact with each other.
What's the assassin's name?
Riven, I think.
Who?
Riven.
Yeah, yeah, Riven. That's right.
But it was never, there was never like a paragraph that kind of explained it, and I can understand right. that, because I'm not sure if this particular book was meant for somebody to start off with. But yeah.
Yeah, and I think you got the main point of it, is that Jack's a do-gooder, you know?
Right.
And I think that's the main part of what you need to understand.
Yeah. And even he's changing, because after his run-in with that creature, he probably will burn things from now on.
He'll probably burn things?
Yeah, kill and burn.
Yeah. He's certainly much more careful now.
Yeah.
So, how much do you know about these creatures that they ended up being?
Just whatever's in the book.
Okay,
so I haven't used them in my game yet.
You've never messed with Slod before?
No.
They're sort of, historically, they're sort of the creatures that embody chaos.
Okay.
and generally, I guess, chaotic evil. They're sort of forces of destruction in sort of the old blood war, devils versus demons sort of thing. They were free agents that didn't care. They didn't even get involved. They would show up and destroy things.
Right.
So, I mean, I guess that's what they are. I'm still not entirely sure how or why they fit into this story, but I think that's supposed to still be a mystery.
Right.
You know, there's some hints that there's another somebody out there leading them, and there's a reason that they're doing these things. Because I was surprised, because Slod are, you know, embodiments of chaos, and I was thinking, well, because when I was trying to figure out what it was, I'm like, oh, well, what sort of matches this description and has shape-shifting abilities and all this kind of stuff? Well, and Slod don't really have shape-shifting abilities, but they later sort of just explained how they do. They were granted shape-shifting abilities specifically because of what they're doing.
Right.
So, yeah, I really don't... I'm not sure that I get their motivation yet, other than it seems like they're bound and they're trying to fight for their freedom.
Right.
And I guess being creatures of chaos, that would be important.
Well, and it's pretty crazy because in order for the one guy, the bigger guy that is with the ranger at the end.
Uh-huh.
You know how they meet up with the ranger and then they start going?
Yeah, yeah. I'm with you.
That guy...
I finished the book several weeks back, so I'm trying to remember names as well.
It sounds like they must have known in advance that the ranger might go there and set him up with some other guy to go with him. Like that, I think that needed more planning than just happen to be in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, I mean, if that guy was with the ranger the whole time, then maybe the ranger was...
Friends of Ribbon.
Yeah, yeah, Magadon or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, Magadon. Who's not only a ranger, but also the psionicist, right?
Yes.
Which I found an interesting combination as well.
Right.
Now, I wonder if, because this was written, if I'm not mistaken, during the third edition days.
Okay.
When multiclassing was commonplace. People would just sort of jump in and out of different classes like crazy.
Right.
So it made a lot of sense for people to just have a mishmash of different powers and what have you.
Right.
I'll be curious to talk to Paul, the author, later on to see if writing these stories in the fourth edition era changes the way he would have done that.
Right.
And psionics is one of those things that's fairly uncommon anyway, but it seems to have shown up in several of the novels that I've been reading. You know, in the realm, psionics is very rare,
right?
And yet there seems to be a psionic character in almost every book I've read lately.
Oh really?
Yeah.
Oh, the guy's name is Nestor,
the big guy.
Yeah,
right on. All right, so where were we?
You wanted to talk more about D&D stuff.
I think I was just going to comment on the whole mishmash of everybody has multiple classes thing.
Okay.
I actually created a version of Erebus Kale for temporary hit points.
Oh yeah?
That I published over there. I did a first level version of him, and I don't think he would have been first level at this point, but...
Yeah, I don't think he would have spied very long
for something. No. I mean, it's one of those stories where they sort of assume that, you know, everybody's sort of a badass, you know?
Right.
And so you're like, well, in the grand scheme of things, that would almost make them, you know, at least high paragon. But in reality, they're probably, you know, mid-heroic.
Right.
But because of the way it's written, they're always constantly sort of being described as being really badass. You know, one of my favorite characters in the whole thing, though?
Yeah.
Was, that crazy sage that they went and visited, the numbers guy.
Oh yeah, he's pretty cool.
And I think he has, on one hand, he has an interesting story. You know, and there's some interesting things about him. He's sort of this tragic character who's a chosen of Ogma and has all this information and understands all these things, but he understands them as numbers, and it makes him completely unable to sort of interact with the rest of society.
Right.
On the other hand, as somebody who went to a school with a lot of engineers and who married an engineer, I know that stereotype. And I'm not saying engineers are that way, but I know people that were that way.
Right, where they see everything,
you know,
as an equation.
Everything's an equation, or everything's numbers, or whatever. But they don't have strong social skills. You know.
Right.
Again, not all engineers are that way. But there are some engineers who are that way, and I've met some. And so I don't know if that is a common enough stereotype or archetype or whatever that most people would have noticed that, but it certainly stood out to me.
Oh, yeah, no, I noticed it, I think.
And he was, on the other hand, he was an interesting character because I don't know if, on one hand, I really enjoyed the interactions with him, and it gave the author a chance to do a lot of sort of foreshadowing about what was going to happen and where this stuff was going. You know, cause now I'm starting to comb through all these numbers and figure out, well, what does that mean? You know, Erebus was 1 of 7. Riven was 2 of 7. Okay. Well, who are the other 5? You know? And so it leaves a lot of questions and opens a lot of mysteries that grabs my attention. On the other hand, though, it's almost, at times, sort of a goofy, silly part of the story, and a story that otherwise doesn't have any goofy silliness going on at all. So it almost, you know, takes me out of what's going on otherwise. Does that make sense?
You didn't think the female sorceress or whatever her class was a little goofy?
That was working with the bad guys?
Yeah, I forget her name. I forget names very easily. I'm sorry about this.
I don't know that I would have qualified her as goofy.
Well, she had that throwaway line about how she wishes she could have slept with him before killing him.
I think she's cocky. I think she... I'm not saying she doesn't provide some a little bit of comic relief.
Mm.
I think she does, but I don't think she has an inherent goofiness about her. Whereas I think the mathematician guy, I think there is a sort of an inherent goofiness about it. But at the same time, it's sort of an uncomfortable goofiness, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, you're really goofy and silly and whatever and hard for people to understand and people don't take you seriously and all these things. But at the same time, there's a real tragic story with you.
Right.
You know? So I don't know whether or not, like, it gives me mixed emotions because on one hand, I feel bad for the guy, and on the other hand, I'm supposed to be laughing at him, I think.
Right.
And I don't know that I feel comfortable laughing at somebody that's so tragic.
Yeah, I didn't feel the need to laugh at him. I don't know how to explain it, but I just saw him as the stereotypical seer, who are always a little eccentric.
Yeah, I suppose, but he's more than a little eccentric. I mean, even his own temple sort of keeps him away from people.
Right.
And discourages people from getting his help and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
So, I don't know. I also found it interesting, I think, because the book I read right after that also dealt tangentially with the Temple of Ogma. So I keep running into these themes in books that were written years apart from each other.
Right.
But I happen to be reading them near each other. Have we discussed the book?
I guess.
Anything else you want to talk about?
Where's I'm it? Torn.
Okay. What are you torn about? Speak
the
it.
Female characters.
Okay, give it to me. What about them?
Okay, so there's no... There don't have to be female characters in here. I'm not saying that at all.
Uh-huh.
But the ones that were and the lack of other ones, like, I enjoyed the book, but I couldn't really get into it. I didn't really have a pathway into it.
Okay.
And so it doesn't require a female character, but I'm not trying to say that. But it would have been easier for me if there was one that I could have identified with.
And saying all the female characters were either evil.
Right.
Or
a love interest.
Or a love interest that doesn't get along with the rest of the group very well.
Right. And then the wife of the other guy, like, she was okay. She was pretty cool, but we didn't really get to know much about her.
Yeah.
It was kind of a neutral thing.
I could see that. Yeah. And I guess in fairness, the evil female characters weren't really female anyway. They were slods taking female form.
Right.
So, I mean, I don't know that you could make an argument of sexism or anything in the book. I don't think you're trying to.
No.
But yeah, I mean, I guess that's not something I noticed because I don't have that problem.
yeah, no, and it just, it had some interesting takes on a very traditionally masculine story.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, I mean, and that's the how I came away from it. It emphasizes the masculine a lot. Like, he has to, he's still pining for her, and he's trying to prove himself good enough for her, mm-hmm. And stuff like that.
He's a very conflicted fellow, though, isn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, he's pining for her, and he wants to be good enough for her, but he knows he can never have her, and he wants to move on and get away from her.
Right.
And he wants to fight his destiny, but he keeps walking down the path of destiny sort of to see where it goes.
Well, the thing is, it's not like he's trying to get away from her because he'll be happier. That wasn't what I got from it. I got it's better for her if he's not around.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think it was completely... I think there was some possible selfish motives there as well. I don't think it was just, he may have said or was convincing himself right. or whatever that it was all for her. But in reality, I think it was, well, it's never going to happen. And my life will also be easier if I don't have to be around her.
Right.
You know, tempted to go that route or whatever.
Right.
You know, I found it interesting that they sort of built this background in the story that there's this long history with Jack and Erebus. That they sort of have this relationship and friendship and they're always together and helping each other out on these adventures and things.
Right.
Jack felt very much like a secondary character in this story. You know, he didn't really feel like the partner of Erebus in the story. Riven felt like the partner.
Right.
And
that's because he kind of pushes Jack off as seeing Jack's my conscience. He's not my partner in this. He's the one that's supposed to stop me from doing this.
Yeah. I just find, you know, there's a lot of stories where I think it would have been much more typical for Jack to play a bigger role. But, I mean, he doesn't even... in the short story that's sort of the prequel, Jack is barely mentioned.
Right.
And there's this unlikely collaboration between Riven and Erebus who are, you know, enemies of each other. And then Jack... doesn't even really make much of an appearance through the main book for most of the way through it, you know?
Right.
It seems like he just sort of shows up about halfway through. I did really like sort of the precautions and the discussion about all that kind of stuff that they've worked with each other long enough that they have this system in place on how to get a hold of each other.
Right.
You know, because they've sort of existed in this world of assassins and thieves and what have you. So they can't just find each other. It's they rent a room and he's got to go to the room and light the lantern and then go somewhere else. And they'll meet in one of these three places, you know, within the next 24 or 48 hours and whatever. And I'm like, wow, that's a really intricate system. And I understand why they did that. But man, he needs help now. And if it takes 2, 3, 4 days for him to get help, he's screwed.
Right. Yeah, no. And that's the sort of stuff, too, I might steal for a game or something. You know, to make their world richer or whatnot.
Uh-huh.
And I did like the fireball scene. That was like out of a movie.
What fight was that in?
When they're sitting in the tavern.
Oh, when they blew up the tavern. Yeah.
He's like, run!
Oh, and they got their butts handed to them in that fight in the alleyway.
Yeah.
Which I found interesting because the heroes got their butts handed to them and yet still believe themselves to be so badass that when it came down to it, they were going to win this fight.
Well, there's nothing else they could do because they're on a mission from their god.
They could have gotten help. They could have gone to the local guard. They could have done a lot of things.
I know.
But they believe themselves to be so badass that they can handle it themselves.
I also like how they always end up with what they need, even if they don't get everything they wanted out of a fight.
Mm-hmm. Give me an example.
Well, like getting the other half of the globe. Well, getting half of the globe to begin with, and then the other half later. And I want to know what happened to his sword, but I don't think we fully find that out yet. At least I didn't get what fully happened to his sword yet.
Yeah. Now, did the whole shadow magic thing, was that confusing to you at all? Because there is sort of a history of that from another... from other novels in the realms. And I didn't know if you kind of grasped what was going on with the whole shadow magic thing.
I don't think I grasped at all. I mean, I couldn't tell whether or not his sword originally if there was any chance of it having the shadow stuff, or if, as they said, it must have come from the globe.
Right. I don't know why the sword is infused with this shadow magic, but in the third edition realms and before, magic was this thing called the Weave that was controlled by the goddess of magic Mistra. And actually was the goddess. She was the Weave itself. And that's where magic came from. And then through third edition or so, they sort of explored this idea of, well, if magic is like a weave, like the threads of a rug or a blanket or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. Then there is space between the threads.
Okay.
Of emptiness. And that Char, the goddess of secrets and shadows and what have you, sort of used that gap between the threads of the weave to create the shadow weave.
Okay.
Which is sort of her own version of magic that she gets to be in charge of, but it's super secretive, being the goddess of secrets. That would make sense, right?
Right. Because, I can see that, because you can kind of picture the air, if you want to look at the opposite way, the air is weaving around the fabric.
Right. But the way that's been described in the past is that the two types of magic don't interact well. So if you're a wizard or whatever, and you cast detect magic to see if there's magic auras in the round,
okay,
or in the area, you can't detect shadow weave, or it's really hard to do so.
Okay, so that would explain why there were times when he thought he should have been able to detect something and he didn't.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
And why the one wizard that was the villain, they couldn't figure out his magic very well because he's a shadow mage. Right. He's a shadow mage, so he's using a different kind of magic. So yeah, I think there were some things that they just sort of threw in there like that they never really explained. And I don't know if that was a problem for you or not, but
I just figured there was probably some counterspell that they didn't bother to put in the book. That was why they didn't, because I mean they have lots of that, right? Because he spends that whole time
putting a protective wards and things.
Yeah, on his half of the spear near the beginning of the book, mm-hmm. so that way they don't find him right away,
mm-hmm.
and it buys him a few hours. So like, there could be stuff like that still, I think.
Well, and I wonder if, and I'm pretty sure this is the way it's going, but I think there's going to be a bigger role for Char, this goddess of shadow and secrets,
right?
In the future books, she's also the goddess that sort of is in charge of the Shade Enclave, which I think is going to come up later.
Right.
Because it's a city made of shades, and that's the only shades sort of in existence, except Erebus now. So she sort of makes an appearance, in that temple at the end. There's statues of her, and then there's a little statue of Mask sort of nearby. And I think, if I'm remembering my cosmology correctly, Mask is actually one of the children of Char.
Okay.
And so that's sort of his relationship. He's not as evil as she is. Or as powerful as she is. But he is, her progeny. So there's a relationship there.
Right. So were you yelling at Riven at the end to grab something on his way out?
I wasn't. But maybe I should have.
Because Riven had already accepted his destiny, so he definitely should be able to pick something from the Fane. Right?
Because they said that everybody could take something, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
and the only person who got anything was Kale, the book.
Was Erebus. Yeah.
All right, Erebus, Kale, yeah.
Now, in theory, he actually got two things, right?
Yeah.
He also got transformed into a shade, which was the big thing that the other guy was. Was it Vragan? Was that the wizard?
Or am I thinking? I believe so, yeah.
Okay. That the bad guy wizard wanted. That was the big thing he wanted, was to become a shade.
Right.
So.
Yeah, and they killed him.
Well, and I had my suspicions, like, since before they even got to Westgate, that Kale was going to end up becoming a shade.
Right.
So, I don't know. I'll be curious to see, and then when he got his hand cut off, or eaten off, I was pretty sure at that point he was going to become a shade.
Right.
Because that's when I figured out, oh, he's going to get his hand back by becoming a shade.
Right.
So, I think the foreshadowing was nice, though, because it wasn't really solid that it was going to happen, but I was pretty sure, especially by that point, that it was probably going to happen. And there was a lot of foreshadowing and hints that along the way that was going that direction.
Wait, he wasn't going to get a mechanical hand?
I never suspected he was going to get a mechanical hand. And magical hands, in D&D books and stories are a bit overdone as well.
Right.
So. All right. Well, any last thoughts? I think we talked through the things that I remember I wanted to talk about.
I can't think of anything else.
All right. Well, this is probably a good time to stop because we're going to go off in a moment here and talk to the author, Paul S. Kemp, about the book and see about some of his thoughts as he was writing it.
Sweet.
All right. So that's our discussion of the book. Next up, we chatted with Paul S. Kemp, the author of the book, and maybe had some of our questions answered along the way.
All right, so we are now here with Paul S. Kemp, author of Twilight Falling and other books. And he's going to talk to us a little bit about the book that we just discussed and share some of his insights about what it was like to write it and work on it and all that kind of stuff. So first of all, where did this story come from? You know, what was going through your head that sort of created this concept for you?
Well, I'll give you the whole background from just sort of a process standpoint. You know, what precedes the Erebuscale trilogy is the Sembia series of books in the Forgotten Realm. So I wrote a first short story, kind of Kale's origin story in the Hall of the Stormweather, followed that with the first novel in Shadow's Witness. That seemed to go over reasonably well with the fans. So then we went on to the entire trilogy. In concept, I mean, what I really wanted to sort of deal with and fiddle around with here was, the anti-hero kind of right on the edge of redemption. It's, you know, in my own mind, Kale is a guy who sort of walks up to that line all the time, teeters right on the edge of final and ultimate redemption, but just cannot get himself there, either because there's some component of his psychology that prevents him from getting there, because events conspire to prevent him from getting there, and so forth. So I wanted to toy around with that. In the process of doing that, I really like playing with ideas like themes like fate versus determinism, which is one of the critical things in this book, and kind of and you'll see this in the latter two books of the trilogy, the notion of subjectivism and objectivism from a moral perspective. So kind of on the one hand, the sort of Nietzschean ideal, and on the other hand, this kind of like Platonic one. And these two things come into, probably that doesn't make any sense to you at all, having only read the first book, but as you go on and learn more about the Sojourner, the character you'll meet in book two, and who plays a key role in books two and three, those themes play out pretty clearly in his character and the kinds of things that he's trying to do, and that Kale, Riven, and Jack get caught up in.
Right on. Yeah, one of the
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to step ahead.
No, go ahead.
Usually, because you asked the question, I probably didn't answer it. I tend to ramble a little bit, sort of lawyeritis here. But for me, typically what I do is when I'm writing any story, I always start with the characters. And I try to get really, as far as I can, into their head, and we come up with the protagonist and his motivation, and then we develop the antagonist and their motivation. Those two things are obviously at loggerheads, and from that the story kind of sprouts. So for me, always it's the concept derives from the character sketching.
I'm curious then, you say that you start with this concept of the protagonist and the antagonist of the story and who those characters are and what their motivations are. When you wrote Twilight Falling, who's the antagonist? Because I could see a couple of different directions to go with that.
Well, you know, I mean, strictly speaking, the antagonist is Bragan and the shape-shifting slots. There's a larger antagonist that looms behind all of that, which gets itself revealed later. And there is, at least at the outset, he doesn't meet the definition of antagonist, but Riven plays a bit of a foil to Kale, obviously, and Jack in particular, throughout the story. So he has some aspects of an antagonist that he seems to occasionally run contrary to the protagonist's goals and motivations and so forth, but ultimately that's not Riven's role. Riven and Jack are really, and I'm sure this is obvious to all of your readers, but you know, Kale is the guy who sort of teeters on the sword's edge, and Riven and Jack are the guys on either side of it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Riven is the man that Kale is desperate not to become, but fears he already is, and Jack is the man, more, this is morally man, who Kale would like to be, but fears he could never be. And he's probably right about that.
You're right. So they play the role of sort of the devil and the angel on the shoulder.
Exactly.
Now, but at the same time, you say the antagonist is Vragan and the Slod, but as you get towards the end of the book, it becomes clear that those two groups are not on the same side.
That's right. That's right. And this gets at, as the book club hopefully continues on with Dawn of Night, Midnight's Mass, you'll meet the actual force behind it. So, as I say, that's when things sort of get escalated, and even I like to think even more interesting with the Sojourn.
Okay.
That last scene when they're running out, why didn't somebody grab something? That's the only thing I can think of.
When they're running out of the Fane of Shadows under the lake?
Yeah.
Yeah.
See, we all think about, this is a funny thing, I sort of think about things sometimes in that way too, because it's almost like because are you a gamer, Tracy?
Yeah.
Yeah, see, we all tend to, we sort of, and I do this all the time too, and it's a good thing in a way, but we all sort of conceptualize all of these, a lot of the books that we read, particularly Sword and Sorcery, and particularly tie in Sword and Sorcery like this, the way we would if we were gamers. So you analyze actions at one remove. You're kind of like, man, if that was my character and I was hauling ass out of there, I'd have grabbed a whole bunch of shit, and I would have too if I were, because you're not in, obviously, since you're playing a PC, you're sort of not in the heat of that moment, and you're not rush of adrenaline where your mind's not working clear, and the only thing that's really registered in your mind is I gotta survive, I just gotta move.
Right.
So the way I sort of think about it as to why guys don't always take the optimal action in any particular cases, I try to, when sort of the world's about to crash down and that's that and this is the end. And by and large, I'm not sure that people are thinking, let me grab something. Now, I suppose arguably one might say, hey, man, grab something because maybe it'll get you out or maybe it'll give you a way out. But they didn't have any basis to think that would be true. So I think, in my opinion, just running and sort of that, fight or flight instinct was triggered, and there was no rational thought going on at that point.
So speaking of the interaction of how we think about the books as gamers, it seems clear to me anyway that the book was written set in the third edition version of the Forgotten Realms.
Yes.
How much of a role does that play in the way you write the characters and the stories and all that?
That's a good question. It's I try to respect the rules, but I really regard them, and I hope this doesn't offend any gamers out there, but I really regard them purely as guidelines. And the thing that I always try to adhere to very strictly, although there's one exception in Erebus Kill, truly, that's a fairly big exception, and some folks who really follow the setting have called me on this one. But when it comes to the actual lore of the setting, I try to strictly adhere to all of that. When it comes to the rules that are designed to model actions that occur in the for people who play the game outside of the setting, those I really tend to regard primarily as guidelines. So, I'll deviate them from time to time. You can't just run amok, obviously. So, for example, this is 3-5, and Priest, when Kale prays the mask for because he's pissed and he wants spells that are going to harm his enemies, that, he's got to pray for spells. I mean, it's not like, it isn't, say, 4th edition where you've got these, but it's a little bit of a different kind of mechanic. But I try really hard, and you can't always put it, obviously, but I try quite hard to not want the underlying mechanics to be integral, stories to last for a long time and still be an enjoyable read for people. And I don't want, and a lot of the people who read are gamers. I mean, I have a lot of readers who aren't gamers at all, but a lot of them are, and it can throw those folks out entirely if they bump into something that is a identifiable mechanic from one edition and is not associated with the current, more popular edition that's being played. For example, this happened, and there's nothing they could do about it, but this happened with Bob Salvatore and Elaine Cunningham, when they wrote, when Bob wrote the Dark Elf trilogy and Elaine wrote the Daughter of the Drow trilogy, you know, they all the Drow at that time, at least the Dow said they could just levitate. It was a natural innate ability, and they had a certain kind of night vision and all of that, mm-hmm. and their weapons deteriorated as soon as they hit sunlight and all that. Well, as soon as that was all second edition stuff, but as soon as we moved to third edition, all of that changed. So everything that they had written, and some of that was critical to their stories, you know, deteriorated, that you didn't have to have a noble sort of insignia in order to levitate and so forth, it kind of screwed up their stories. Now, those because they're well-written, but, you know, it can throw somebody out because they're going, what the hell's the writer talking about? Because you get a reader who's never played those old editions, and they don't have any idea at all what's going on with that. So I try to avoid it. It plays a role because you can't avoid writing at the end of the day, tie-in fiction that relates to a game world. But insofar as I can avoid any kind of overt sort of reliance on addition, idiosyncratic ability, I do so. So, for example, now I'm in the process, I've written the first book of the, you guys are reading Erebus Kale trilogy, after that comes the Twilight War trilogy, and after that comes the Cycle of Night trilogy, and I've written the first book of that, and that is set well into the future of the Forgotten Realms and ostensibly use its fourth edition mechanics, but I almost never look at the rule books while I'm writing the story. I have a time to have to model what the characters can do, at least broadly, but I almost never look at the rule books for that stuff. So I mean, it's just not the kind of story I want to tell. I mean, I want to tell a story about characters and hopefully something that gets you turning pages quickly when we're in the midst of combat, gets your heart rate up a little bit, you know, at the end of some of these, you know, evoke some emotional response, has some resonance for people, and I'm not particularly interested in tying it to game rules.
Yeah, and in terms of, because one of the, sometimes when I, oftentimes when I read D&D-based novels, I relate it in my head to certain truisms about a D&D game or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always interesting because very seldom do authors write books that have a healer in the group?
Hmm.
You know, for whatever reason, yeah. there's never a cleric. Now you've got two. You got two, but at the same time, everybody's also a rogue. So,
right. Well, you know why you avoid clerics? Because it is damn hard to keep the stakes really high if everybody can quickly heal up after every time they're wounded and so on. Yeah. You know, the sort of the wounded warrior pushing through his pain and fatigue and all of that is kind of a classic trope of sword and sorcery, and that can be made to go away when you have clerics. So, but I've always loved clerics. Even when I play D&D, I play clerics all the time. Just love the class, love the whole notion of working religion and religious themes in the story. So invariably, I have religious characters in all of my stories. That's true of both Kale Trilogy, Twilight War, and then the Cycle of Night.
But you also seem to have an affinity for rogues.
Yes, absolutely. Well, they're just fun. I mean, well, you know, you think, and I keep saying sword and sorcery. That's because that's the way I think of my work. When you think, you know, sword and sorcery, you think Conan, so you get your sort of barbarian archetype. You think Fafhrd and the Grey Monster, so you kind of have your two sort of rogue archetypes there, and those are the classic traveling sword and sorcery, you know, adventurers. So yeah, rogues and so on. Place it up with the cleric, I guess.
Hold on. Now, one of the other things that I, having been a third edition Forgotten Realms fan, one of the things that was unique about that version of the realms was the introduction of the shades,
yes.
And the shade enclave and all that. Now you approach that concept, but almost completely, at least in this book, almost completely circumvent the story as presented about who the shades are and where they come from.
That's right.
Now, does that come in later on? Should I expect to see more of that? Or is that you sort of saying that there's exceptions to the rule as well? Or,
well, yeah. See, my experience with shades goes back to AD&D, and if you remember the Monster Manual 2, mm-hmm. with the shade entry there by Gary Gygax, and it's all that it talked about then was individuals who have bonded through unholy rituals with shadow stuff,
mm-hmm.
and it didn't have anything to do with a political organization or any ethnic group or nationality having a monopoly on the ability to transform one into a shade. And truth is, actually, Twilight Falling was written and turned in before Troy Denning's Return of the Archwizards. I didn't even know Shade was coming back at the time that I did it. And I had Kale pegged to become a Shade as a, you know, real early in Shadow's Witness. I figured that was the direction I was going to push. Witness was about his faith. Aaron's trilogy is about him being transformed by his faith. And then the Twilight War is about something a little bit. But yeah, I mean, I had that sort of way. So indeed, I think the way you characterize it is fair. It is a little bit of those instances where the rules, although the rules aren't, you know, it doesn't really run afoul of the rules exactly. Right. It's just one of the ways in which one can become a Shade that is not documented in the lore.
Sure. Well, and it's interesting that you say you wrote this prior to having read Return of the Archwizards.
Right.
Series, because if I'm remembering that series correctly, that's also introduces heavily the themes of the Shadow Weave.
Yes.
Which you seem to tap into some of those themes in this book. I was actually explaining to Tracy what the concept of the Shadow Weave is, because she doesn't have this background in lore, of what the Shadow Weave is and how it's hard to detect and doesn't interact well with normal magic and all that kind of stuff. And you sort of briefly hit on some of those ideas.
Yes.
And so it's interesting that you did that, even though you hadn't read the other book that sort of established some of that.
Yeah, that's right. Well, that's because we get sort of advanced copies of all of the rule books and so on. So I had some sense of how the weave was going to develop. I can't, looking back now, I don't remember if it was just Phil Athens who sent me material to that when we said, okay, well, I'm going to have him become a Shade. Actually, did I just give a spoiler for book two? Because I'm thinking of the way book one. Okay. Yes, I touched on the Shadow Weave stuff.
Very good. Well,
I did just say that.
No, go ahead.
Nothing. I was just saying that is actually a big spoiler. That's a whole big, big part of book two. Oh, forget I said that. You can edit that one out.
Excellent. So I've dominated most of the questions here for the last 15, 20 minutes, and I don't want to take up too much of your time. I want to see if Tracy has any other thoughts or questions she wanted to ask.
Go ahead.
I know there's one question she wants to ask, but I want to see if she has the guts to do it.
Well, said, I'm easy. I'm not offended at it.
He's going to make me talk about it.
Yes, I am.
So I was just curious about, so it seems like it's a very masculine story. Was it intentional to leave,
yeah,
to not have as many female characters? That's what I figured.
No, see, that's a fair question, but I asked it. It is,
it's a very tricky subject to talk about lately. So.
No, it's really not. I mean, it is, but in that case, it's not. I mean, the way that I've thought about it, generally speaking, I'll get somebody to say, well, characterize your writing. And I'll say, generally what I do is I write stories that feature protagonists who embody sort of the old Roman concept of virtus, which is this kind of virtue of strength and courage and fortitude and friendship and brotherhood and so on. The Romans attributed that all, generally speaking, to men. I don't. It just, what has happened is, I write these stories and I think about them as kind of like, the Sopranos for me. This is like the Sopranos doing sorcery. You're entirely right. Those early stories, I don't have a lot of sort of female roles that are all that important to the stories. Which is why I'm always really pleased when I hear from women who've enjoyed the story. They're always like, thank you for sending me an email. I really appreciate that. So I've actually become conscious of that, and I've tried to – it was entirely unconscious for the most part. When you say it's masculine, I think about it as kind of – for me, that means it's sort of this muscular kind of fantasy a la Conan, where it is very manly, masculine men doing very manly, masculine things, which generally means a lot of violence and solving your problems with fists, not building consensus and being real decisive and action-oriented, not slow to respond and all of that. So all that said, I have tried to take some steps in the other direction because I think, particularly in these early stories, is a bit of a weakness. In fairness to myself, I always tell myself, even though characters like Shimmer and Tazzy in the books don't play real key roles, they are at least presented, I think, in a like Shemur in particular, I think it was a very strong woman. This is the matriarch of the Eskeveren. And even though she has bit parts in throughout all of my books, she, I think, is a very strong woman. I try to present her that way. She just doesn't have a lot of screen time.
Yeah.
So, I think, yeah. Go ahead.
I could say, I think in the beginning of the book, when they have that conversation, I think when he's leaving or something like that, she comes across as being, feeling equal, and Kale seems to view her as an equal almost.
Yes. No, like, I think at least to me, you're absolutely right. That's entirely correct. I mean, in my mind, he has enormous respect for her. He didn't quite understand her fully, but he has enormous respect for her, and I think she has the same kind of respect for him. So, yeah, I mean, I always, generally speaking, I try to present all of the women or female characters who appear in the books reasonably, generally speaking. I mean, like I said, I'm not into, I got to have a certain quota, or every woman has to be really, really strong, and if there's a damsel in distress, I'm an awful human being. And
no.
So on. But you know, it's one of those things where you do, you're right, it's a delicate thing, and you have to, it's just one of those things, you know, from my perspective, just learned as I've gone that I need to work on that. Although, even as I say that, when I look back, like in the Twilight War, there's a female character that's very important, but she's an antagonist and she's nuts. So I don't know if that actually, yeah, I'm not sure if that gets us where we want to go. But
so what you're telling us is that all women are crazy.
They're either crazy or in danger. Yeah, that's basically what I'm saying.
And I have to be honest, this is one of the reasons I hate. Sorry.
Before, and I think it's entirely fair. It's just, you know, like I was saying, it sounds like an excuse, but I start with the characters, and I just the story kind of unfolds. Mm-hmm. And I suppose when I look back, I can always go, well, I can make, you know, this character woman or that character woman, but it, like when I'm conceptualizing the story, it just doesn't seem to, because I'm always thinking of these things in terms of, like, have you ever seen Unforgiven with Clint Eastwood and Morgan Freeman and Gene Hackman? All right, so I mean, I most of my stories are informed by tales like that.
Right.
And so, but, you know, kind of like brotherhood and friendship is always the real intense theme. And I'm probably not helping myself at all here.
No,
but,
no.
But in any event, I develop the characters, and then the story just kind of goes, and then there it is. And then sometimes I look back and somebody says, you know, you don't have very many women in there. It's a very masculine kind of story. And I go, you know, you're right. And that's really all I can say. You're right. I
guess
I'll work on it next time.
And that's the thing. That's why actually I don't like asking this question, even though on Twitter I bring it up enough.
No, I'm glad you did. I really am.
I don't mean it in any sort of accusatory way. I just wanted to make sure, like, I got the right feeling from it. And I have to be honest, when I'm writing stuff for D&D, whether it's my game or on my blog or, you know, freelancing or whatnot, I sometimes even have to force myself to make more female characters because it's just not there. It's not a common enough thing. And I don't think there should be a quota or anything like that either, you know, and the character should be as the character should be. But I just always wonder about it, so I'm glad I got to ask.
No, I'm glad you did. I actually grew up with a really good friend of the writer, Daniel Littrell. He wrote Winter's Bone, which has been into a movie recently, and a handful of other books.
No, I haven't read it.
I had heard an interview with Daniel Woodrell, who wrote Winter's Bone and a bunch of other books, and his books get described by critics, because he was asked a similar question to this, as books, a book written by a man for a man, and because there's a lot of whiskey and fist fights and tavern brawls and all of that stuff, and to some degree, I guess I sort of fit the same bill to a little bit of a lesser degree, but they, you know, they're these kind of hyper masculine protagonists, and they solve a lot of their problems with fists and tough talk and all of that. And that works for some people. It doesn't work for others, but I am working on this. In fact, you know, again, I don't take this in any way where this is not a defensive thing or anything, but my most recent Star Wars book has a female Jedi as the protagonist, and I found that to be really a lot of fun. So, you know, who knows?
Well, I was thinking that
She was tough and awesome, so I don't have any excuse.
I was thinking that the female Slott, I guess she was the one of the the female bad guy.
Oh,
I forget her name right now.
She's always here.
Say it again, Paul. Can you say that again? You were cutting out.
But I liked her. I was like, when she got to that part where she's like, "Oh man, it's gonna be a real shame because I didn't get to sleep with him first." It was like, "Wait, where did that come from?" Because none of the rest of the story has anything like that. I was like, "That's interesting."
Well, so there you go. That's something.
All right. Well, I think we've taken up probably enough of your time, and hopefully we'll get a chance to chat with you again about a month from now about the next book.
Oh, that'd be great. Yeah, I look forward to it, because things change remarkably in the second book. So I really appreciate you guys taking the time and reading the book and so on. It means a lot, so thank you.
Cool. And that's the Book Club Episode 1. I hope you all enjoyed it. I hope you join us for the next one. We're trying to broadcast it live on Ustream.tv, and our next discussion will be on July 29th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. If you want to join us in the chat room on Ustream, that would be great. And if you want to be in the episode to discuss with us, you can email us at thetomeshow@gmail.com. Also, the Wizards of the Coast D&D Novel Book Club has agreed to let us have our own little corner of their forums where we can discuss the book as we read along.
And all the details about the book club and the books will be linked at thetomeshow.com. Check it out. I think it's time to call an end to our first book club episode.
So, Tracy, how was it? Did you have fun?
Yeah, it was good. Got a lot of my questions answered.
And I kind of put you on the spot there with the author, didn't I?
Just a little.
And you only get to talk to him at least two more times. Aren't you excited?
I know. I'm so excited about that. No, actually, yeah. I even talked to him on Twitter a little bit about the next book in the trilogy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw that.
And that was that was really cool. And it helped. Like, I could see some of the stuff that he had mentioned in our discussion in that next book.
Yeah, have you started reading the next book yet?
Yeah, I think I'm about halfway through. Pretty right close.
On. Yeah, yeah. I'm almost halfway through. I'm in the middle of chapter 9 as of this recording. And it's a 20-chapter book, so I will be posting, probably tomorrow, I'll be posting the next chunk for the discussion group on the Wizards community.
Sweet.
Forums. I put up chapter 1 through 5 already, and I'm going to put up my thoughts on chapters 6 through 10 as soon as I get done with that, probably tomorrow.
Cool.
So, yeah, it was a good time. I had fun. I think it can only get better from here. I'd like to interact with some more people, but I hope some other people are reading along and enjoying these books with us. Maybe we'll consider doing something a little bit newer after we finish this trilogy, and see if that grabs some people's attention too. Well, we'll see how it goes.
Okay.
I thought I'd let you pick the next set of books.
Oh, it has to be a set?
Well, it doesn't have to be a set. I figured I'd let you pick the next book. How's that sound?
Okay. Does it have to be a book I haven't read yet?
I suppose not, as long as you're willing to read it again.
Yeah, there's one that I will read again, so.
All right. Very good. Well, then I guess we should probably get going.
Okay.
I want to thank everybody for joining us as we discuss Twilight Falling with Paul S. Kemp, and I hope you join us on the 29th to talk about Dawn of Night, Book 2 of the Erebus Kale Trilogy. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hey, this is Paul S. Kemp, creator of Erebus Kale, and you are listening to The Tome Show.
I'm a monster. Rawr.